It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up on Central Time, we'll hear about the new film Political Predator that takes up the wolf hunt debate in Wisconsin.
First, the Federal Communications Commission voted today to adopt new rules aimed at keeping the internet neutral.
After nearly a year-long process, the FCC's five-member board released their decision earlier this afternoon, setting new rules governing internet access and whether internet providers can provide higher speeds to content providers for a cost. The verdict, net neutrality stays in place, and the internet will be regulated more like a public utility.
This decision is already controversial. While supporters say it'll help guarantee equal access to the internet world, a Republican FCC commissioner says it amounts to government control of the internet and warned of higher costs and taxes for consumers.
Brendan Sasso joins us now. He's a technology correspondent for the National Journal. Brendan, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Well, the FCC passed these new rules today by a vote of 3-2. In broad terms, what did the FCC decide?
Right, well, so the rules themselves say that your internet provider like Comcast or Verizon can't block websites, can't intentionally slow down certain sites, and can't offer some sort of deal where maybe some sites can get preferential treatment, a special fast lane for a fee. The other important part of these rules is not just the rules themselves, but how the FCC justified them legally. So the FCC has to come up with some sort of legal rationale, so how they have the power to do this, and that's been a big source of the debate. They declared that the internet is, in their terms, a telecommunications service. That gives them much broader authority. So the net neutrality advocates say these rules can hold up in court when all the providers try to sue them over it. But the Republicans and other critics worry that this is essentially turning the internet into a utility. There could be a lot of other regulations down the line that might not have nothing to do with net neutrality, but the FCC has sort of opened the door by reclassifying the internet under this provision that was originally written in 1934.
And what kind of obligations come along with treating internet service providers like a public utility?
Right. So this Title II, that's the section of the Communications Act that the FCC is using here, has a lot of different provisions. It's all about, you know, it's originally written for telephones, and it's about ensuring, you know, universal access and fair prices. And FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler said that he's doing sort of a 21st century version of that. So they're waiving a lot of these, the most burdensome provisions. So there won't be price controls, and those kinds of provisions that might be exist for telephones, but they don't want to exist for the internet. And the Republicans, though, are skeptical, and they say that, you know, the FCC has granted itself this authority. Down the line, there's no reason that the FCC couldn't step in and decide that what a provider is charging is unreasonable or unjust and try to change that.
If you look at some of the big internet service providers who are against this, how will things change for them?
Right. So this is, the one thing is that the providers have said all along that net neutrality regulations are unnecessary because they claim that they're all committed to an open internet. So for them, in some ways, they might say that nothing will actually change in their business practices because they weren't planning on blocking your websites or slowing down certain websites. Obviously, not everyone trusted them on that one, which is why we ended up with regulations. But so for them, the change is not just the net neutrality rules themselves, but much greater government oversight of their business practices generally. And in fact, part of the provisions, these apply to both your home internet connection and your smartphone connection, so it's just both mobile and fixed internet. There could be data caps that wireless providers have could now fall under the FCC's oversight. How much data you're allowed to use in a month could be something that the FCC is looking at. T-Mobile, for example, has a program called Music Freedom, I believe, where they exempt all music services from data caps. So you can use Spotify for free. It wouldn't be under your or at least it wouldn't count against your data caps. And so this is something that the FCC could theoretically take a look at. Doesn't mean they will get rid of that T-Mobile policy, but those kinds of network management practices could now fall into the FCC's oversight.
Now, we've been using the term net neutrality freely as we talk about this, but just to back up a little, can you talk a little bit about what that concept and how today's rules relate?
Right. Net neutrality basically is the idea that all internet traffic should be treated equally. There's this fear that your internet provider like Comcast or Verizon has a lot of control over what you can do online. People sort of think now of the internet as being this core communication service. It's how we express ourselves online. It's how new innovative services start up. So there's a fear that these providers are in a position to be like gatekeepers, and they could decide what people can say online, or you know, what sort of businesses might be able to succeed, what might end up in a slow lane or a fast lane. So the idea is that there should be rules to prevent these internet providers from manipulating what you can access online. So that was the idea behind these new regulations.
Now, these rules have been a long time coming, very hotly debated. What was it the most commented on in the FCC's history?
Right. It was 4 million people filed comments.
What does that tell us about what's at stake here for companies and for internet users?
Right. I think that this, in some ways, this issue is this kind of wonky telecom thing. We're talking about Title II of the Communications Act, and some elements of it get very technical. But I think on a broad level, it gets to how important the internet is in people's lives. You know, it's a way to maybe share silly cat videos, but it's also, you know, how we stay in touch with loved ones and how people express their political opinions online. And so I think there's a fear that a company like Comcast, which, you know, people have a lot of complaints about and maybe don't trust, could, you know, manipulate that platform for their own ends. And so people want to see something to stop that. On the other end, I think there's fear that now the government is going to be controlling the internet and what people can access, or at least declaring, you know, that everything has to be equal as a way of the government intervening and overseeing the internet in a way it has never before. So I think that's, it really comes down to who controls the internet. And on the one side, there's fear about corporations controlling the internet, and on the other side, it's fear about the government controlling the internet.
And the president himself got involved at one point. People are expressing his view. He sort of nudged Tom Wheeler on this. Do you have any observations about how this whole thing went down politically?
Right. So the FCC is an independent agency, so it's not necessarily bound to do what the president says. But and usually presidents don't get involved in FCC proceedings. It's usually kind of, you know, not something that rises to that level. And President Obama has always supported net neutrality on sort of a broad level. But last November, he stepped in while the FCC was considering its rules, and it says, and he said, you know, I really would prefer that you use Title II, that you use these sort of utility-style powers. And that obviously put a lot of pressure on Tom Wheeler. You know, he said today that he didn't think of it as, you know, an order, that he's an independent regulator and he made his own decision. But, you know, there are two other Democrats on the commission, and so for Tom Wheeler to do anything, he had to get their votes. And so I don't know if they would have bucked the president, you know, and it's certainly at the end of the day, it made it almost politically impossible for the FCC to do anything other than what the president had said. Would they have ended up in the same place anyway? Maybe, but it was pretty clearly a decisive moment.
We're talking right now about the new decision on net neutrality from the FCC with Brendan Sasso, technology correspondent for the National Journal.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you been tracking this issue, making the case one way or the other? What do you think about this announcement from the FCC today? Should the internet be treated as a public utility? Do you want to see the government stepping in and having more regulation? Or do you think that the communications providers can handle it and can innovate and do what needs to be done? Call in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation about today's FCC decision on broadband regulation and internet neutrality. The new rules aim to make sure that all users and content providers have equal access to the internet, and the FCC's plan would regulate the industry more like a utility.
You can join in with your thoughts on today's decision and your questions for our guest. Was this decision what you were hoping for? Are you worried that extra taxes or fees could one day be on the way? Or is this the right decision for equal internet access? Call at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And before we get to our callers right now, as we stay with Brendan Sasso from the National Journal, there were obviously critics of this, and among the arguments against it from some Republicans and some companies, that this could discourage innovation. What is that argument?
Right. Well, I think the basic argument is just that when you put all the sort of heavy-handed regulatory regime on the internet, that it's going to discourage companies from investing. You know, if you're Verizon or Comcast or whoever, you're making a decision about how much do you want to spend and how much do you want to invest in your network. And if you know that down the line you could have the FCC determining, you know, how you manage that network, whether you even potentially deciding what prices you charge, although, you know, the supporters of the rules say it wouldn't do that. You know, the critics say that that's going to discourage companies from wanting to spend money to build faster and better internet to people. And if there are, you know, sort of innovative network management services, maybe, you know, a company could give you ESPN would not count against your data cap or something like that. You'd have, you know, that would get a faster service. And maybe that would be good for consumers, that companies are not going to want to experiment with that because they could end up getting fined by the FCC. So we end up with a situation where the internet is sort of locked into place the way it is now, as opposed to trying maybe some new ways to manage networks and deliver traffic.
Let's go to our callers now. Julian joins us first from Milwaukee. Hi, Julian.
Hi, I was calling. I want to make two quick points. The first being that out of we pay, I believe it's the third highest rate in the world for internet service in the U.S., and we're rated somewhere around 27 to 32 as terms for speed that you get for what you pay. The second being that the claims of increasing cost, there was a report on the Huffington Post earlier this month that that although it didn't take into consideration cost of support for the network, but that spread out between all of their divisions, for Time Warner Cable is making 97% profit on their internet at the $50 price range, and they offer tiers above that, which would be even higher cost, higher profit margins of 97%. And then they have to factor in things like support, but I mean, still that's factored out across between, because the support that does TV also does phone and internet. So those costs would be less than 97%, but still ridiculous for anything you could ever hope to imagine as far as a profit margin.
All right, thanks a lot for your thoughts, Julian. And Brendan, questions of speed and questions of profits. Do we know any hard figures about how those could shake down?
Yeah, I don't have the sort of figures in front of me, but I think that, you know, all these providers have invested billions and billions of dollars to build the internet, you know, and so they might feel like, you know, a company like Google or Netflix gets to deliver that content, and there's no real, you know, the providers aren't able to charge them to deliver that content. So you have companies like Netflix and Google that are making billions of dollars when it's companies like Verizon and Comcast that have, you know, built the internet and, you know, dug up the roads to lay the fiber and the cable. And so, you know, they feel like if they have the government now restricting or dictating how they manage their networks, that that could, you know, that there's a certain element where they feel that that's unfair given how much they've invested in the networks.
All right, well, thank you for that call. Another one quick from John in Beaver Dam. Hi, John.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good, thanks.
Hey, I'm in favor of this regulation like a utility, and for a couple different reasons. One is, like the previous caller said, the speeds. I think this would encourage higher speeds, along with nowadays everything is being IP-driven, IP services. And I think one of the biggest factors here is customer service. If it's regulated like a utility, we have better customer service because they would have so much time to fix your internet. Right now, it's not regulated, and we're at the mercy of these big multi-billion-dollar companies like Verizon and AT&T, and the amount of time it takes them to fix our high-speed internet. And when you're a business owner like me, I can't be out of service for 10 days without no internet. And it's crucial that they have these provisions in place so they can come out and fix my service in a timely manner, which is usually 24 hours. Thank you.
All right, John, thanks for the thoughts. And Brendan, what strikes you about that?
Well, I don't think there's anything in the regulations necessarily that would address, you know, customer service issues. I mean, obviously people have their complaints about, you know, Comcast and Time Warner Cable and other companies. I mean, you know, that could be something that could come up right now. The FCC is also reviewing Comcast's bid to buy Time Warner Cable. So, you know, that's something that could come up in that process when they're deciding whether they should let the companies merge. There's nothing in these regulations that necessarily addresses those sort of customer service issues, but I think it probably speaks to just, you know, these companies are pretty unpopular. People don't like them, and often there's not a lot of competition. You don't have a lot of choice, even if you don't like your provider. A lot of people only have one choice or at most two choices for high-speed internet. So I do think that that's, you know, sort of relevant to this debate, that, you know, these companies have a lot of power. It's very hard to pick between providers. And so I think that that is part of a driving motivation between behind these rules.
And as we said, not everybody is happy with these rules today. Are there likely to be legal challenges to today's ruling?
Yeah, almost certainly the providers are going to challenge these regulations in court. Now, the reason that the FCC used this Title II authority to, you know, more or less classify these internet providers like utilities because they thought that that would give them a better legal standing. The FCC had net neutrality rules in 2010, and Verizon sued, and those got struck down. I think today Verizon is probably really regretting that legal challenge. They could have lived with the old rules, and instead they brought this much stronger regulatory regime down upon themselves. But, you know, so the FCC and the net neutrality advocates believe that this Title II telecommunications service classification gives the FCC the sort of legal firepower they need to survive the challenges. But, you know, the order is something like 300 pages long. There are a lot of legal theories and a lot of very high-paid smart lawyers who are going to be going through it and looking for anything that they can cling on to. So, you know, there are certainly going to be challenges that could take years to finally figure out what the result is.
Brendan, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Brendan Sasso, technology correspondent for the National Journal.
A documentary feature from Wolf Advocates in Wisconsin is adding to a letter from scientists and bills in Congress in the growing fight over whether to keep Endangered Species Act protections for the gray wolf in place. Chuck Kornbach has this summary of the latest developments.
The movie is titled Political Predator. It looks at wolf hunting in Wisconsin, which started a few years ago after federal officials took the gray wolf in the western Great Lakes off the endangered species list, and Republican lawmakers and Governor Walker okayed the hunt here. The group Friends of the Wisconsin Wolf is releasing the 67-minute film, which early on criticizes the hunt-friendly politicians and agency administrators.
The policymakers on this issue are as dismissive as they are uninformed. And we thought that the only way we'd have a ghost of a chance to get them to pay attention to us would be to show them that it's not just all the hippie liberals in the capital city that are against the hunt, but also the rural citizens of our great state.
One of the people interviewed in the film is Mary Falk, a sheep, cattle, and goat rancher in Burnett County. Falk uses dogs to help protect her livestock from predators like wolves. She wants her animals to stay alive, but casts doubt on wolf hunting seasons.
Is this really about helping livestock production, or is this about making more money for the state through selling hunter licenses? You know, we hunt. We put food in our freezer. We just don't believe in trophy hunting.
Melissa Smith of Friends of the Wisconsin Wolf says the film tries to show a visual reality.
To know that this isn't the same as deer hunting or fair chase hunting, we really wanted to open people's eyes about the political process.
The movie's release this month comes as some Wisconsin members of Congress are supporting bills that would again temporarily take the gray wolf in much of the U.S. off the endangered species list and potentially restart wolf hunting. Terry Quam is a livestock owner near Lodi and active in the Wisconsin Cattlemen's Association. Quam backs the legislation to control wolves.
We do not want to eradicate them from the earth like a lot of people say we do. We want to just get them under control. And we have to have the measures in them heavily populated areas where you have troublesome wolves going in and taking a very easy shot at farm animals.
Quam does not like a proposal by animal protection groups and about 50 scientists who have signed a letter to Congress asking that gray wolves be moved to threatened status. One of the letter signers, UW-Madison Environmental Studies Professor Adrian Treves, says listing the wolf as threatened would still ban hunting, but allow more help for livestock owners.
And as a threatened species, the state is allowed to apply for permits for lethal control using the systems they have for 15 years. And if farmers believe that's helping them protect their cattle, that's all the flexibility that's needed.
But Dave McFarland of the Wisconsin DNR says for now, the gray wolf is still listed as endangered, meaning farmers can only try non-lethal ways to discourage wolves. For example, a technique called flagery.
Flagery is essentially rope with ribbons hanging from it. And for some reason, behaviorally, wolves are reluctant to cross those lines. And so in small pasture situations, flagry can be effective.
McFarland also says people who lose cattle or pets to wolves can apply for financial compensation. He says a DNR management plan for wolves is in a holding pattern, pending what happens amid all the movies, letters, and legislation about gray wolves. Chuck Quirnbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Melissa Smith is the executive director of Friends of the Wisconsin Wolf. They just released the documentary Political Predator we just heard about, and she joins us now. Melissa, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Why is Friends of the Wisconsin Wolf releasing this film right now?
Well, for two reasons. One, it took us longer in editing than we originally anticipated. When we started filming this, the wolf hunt was still going on. We were actually in northern Wisconsin while wolf hunting was open. So quite a bit has changed from October when we started filming to now when we released the documentary. However, it's really turning out to be a pretty great time with everything that's going on.
And you're concerned about two pending bills that could affect wolf management in Wisconsin if they were passed. What are they?
Well, H.R. 843 has been introduced, and what that would do is if that becomes law, the states of Minnesota, Michigan, and Wisconsin would be given total jurisdiction for wolves again. So it would remove any protection afforded them under the Endangered Species Act, but it is forever. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service wouldn't be allowed to relist the wolf, even if their numbers plummet to unsustainable levels. They would have no oversight for 5 years. The second bill is H.R. 884, and it directs the Secretary of the Interior to reissue an order from 2012 that removed wolves from the endangered species list.
And you'd like to see wolves move to threatened status. Why that?
We would. We did sign on to that as well because, you know, we are very sympathetic to people who lose livestock to wolves. And you know, if you're a small farmer and you've been genetically, you know, even if you get that compensation, sometimes that's not adequate if you've been working on a line of sheep or cows, especially for Wisconsin, northern Wisconsin in cold weather. You know, that can really impact your breeding programs. So we absolutely sympathize. We don't believe that a general trophy or recreational hunt has ever helped with depredation. And we go into that quite a bit in our film to really show the public that the hunt doesn't really have anything to do with controlling depredation. So we are very much support or could support, lethal removal of problem wolves at the time of depredation. So, you know, one of the wildlife biologists talks about if you're losing calves in the spring, a hunt 6 months later doesn't really do a lot of good.
Why not? If you've got wolves that are killing livestock, killing calves, doesn't killing some of the wolves reduce that number of lost livestock?
Well, it reduces wolves, but the thing to know, too, is that when we had the wolf hunt, our lethal controls for farming didn't go away and didn't really decrease. So if wolf hunting was targeting that, at least in our opinion, we wouldn't need the other lethal controls around farms. And there is really hard scientific data about targeting the problem animals and making sure we leave our good wolves where they're supposed to be.
So what you're saying that some wolves are predatory, they prey on livestock, and others leave them alone.
Exactly. And so with the hunt, we know that it was a very small amount of wolves that had anything to do with depredation that were killed in the hunt.
What do we know about the wolf population in Wisconsin today?
I believe, I haven't got the latest numbers, but I think we're around 680 wolves. Our film does go into pretty good depth about criticizing the way we've managed wolves and these groups kind of fixating on this 350 number. One of our big contentions is that trophy hunting, there's no scientifically backed data about what that does to wolves, what it does to their pack structure, whether or not it reduces depredation. There is no decline in deer numbers. So I think we may someday, if I see the science behind it, we might be able to support a small hunt. But as of right now, since we don't know, to us it makes sense to leave them alone.
One of the things up for debate that you get at in this film is the role that wolves play in the ecosystem here in Wisconsin. Some people you record in the film saying that they don't play a role at all. What would you say?
I mean, I don't even think that's debatable in the year 2015. I mean, we have solid scientific evidence that says otherwise. We know that the trophic cascade effect in forests is real. I think that we're really pointing out that we've gone away from science and we've gone to what special interest groups that don't like wolves
believe should happen to wolves instead of what scientists believe should happen with wolves.
Going back to a term that I'm not sure I'm familiar with, trophic cascade, that I'm sure means something about the role wolves play, but could you flesh that out a little for
yeah,
us?
You
Why
bet.
Do wolves
so,
matter in the ecosystem?
Yeah, so let's say in Wisconsin you have a really heavy deer population in one area. Wolves don't just come in and kill those deer. They change the behavior of deer. So deer will keep on the move more so that areas aren't browsed or grazed too heavily. And when that happens, other species, you know, we do have more than two species of animals than wolves or deer in Wisconsin. So it can really be beneficial to songbirds, to small mammals, to even actually helpful to like upland game birds, providing habitat. It even goes down as far as helping fish by repairing those riparian areas around streams and creeks.
We've only got about a minute left here, but Wisconsin, it's a state with a strong tradition of hunting. Do you see a path forward that allows for the interests of hunters to exist alongside the interests of friends of the Wisconsin wolf?
Well, and I think that's very interesting. Most of the people in our film are hunters. We're hunters. Mary Falk is hunters. So I think that hunters are being misrepresented of not liking wolves. We go into that social survey that the DNR did and found that most hunters are actually quite tolerant of wolves. And I think that's kind of one of the more erroneous and dangerous things that the other side has been saying, that the hunting community doesn't like wolves, because we found that not to be true.
Well, Melissa, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, you bet. Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Melissa Smith, Executive Director of Friends of the Wisconsin Wolf.